once more into the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dad.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And you're a little slow on the uptake there.
It's really faint. I'm not hearing it as well.
Well, that's because one of these thingamajiggers here is probably turned down, but
try
I don't know which
the
one.
The headphones is the knob all the way.
Yeah, that one right there?
Yeah, that's the one.
Oh, that we can hear ourselves.
Wow,
that's a little
amazing.
Frightening. Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the Personal Wealth Coach is also a registered investment advisory firm located in Salado, Texas, registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which does not imply either approval or disapproval of the SEC of TPWC. If you understood all that, you're really cool. We're late. We're getting started late, if anyone's still listening. If you're not listening, it doesn't make any difference to you, but the I-35 parking lot was unusually full this morning.
Yes.
And, Lord, I will be very happy if and when the construction ever finishes. I don't think it's ever going to finish.
It doesn't finish. That's the nature of construction, is that it goes on forever. It says that this project is done and the other project has gotten started, but they overlap.
Right. Well, actually, the promised date, and they're quite confident about this, of completion, at least in Salado, is mm-hmm. May of 2015.
Well, yeah.
But they just took the 2015 on. They said May. You know, they moved it to 2016, and now they're just saying May.
It's going
to
be in May
in
of
some
year.
Yeah. Okay. We have a caller on 773-1400, which, by the way, is the local telephone number. You put a 254 in front of it, and you can call it from
254
pretty much anywhere. If you put a 1 plus 254, you can call it from almost anywhere in the world. So, caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was an article in the Wall Street yesterday, global currency soar, defying central bankers. What's the advantage of a weak currency or a strong currency, and can all countries have a weak or strong currency at the same time? I'll hang up and listen.
That's a great question. No, all currencies cannot be weak at the same time
or
strong at the same time
because they're
measured against each other.
No. It's entirely possible for all currencies to be weak at the same time according to the MAC index.
But only if they're all strong at the same time as well.
Well, but the whole point is that actually you measured how many local ducats or dollars or used to be marks.
Right.
Or euros or yen, it takes to buy a Big Mac. That is the international standard of
right.
currency strength.
No, it's not.
Yeah, it is.
It's sort of the international standard.
There's a Big Mac survey that tracks it.
Yes, but it's not very accurate.
I don't know.
This is a statistical thing. It's like saying, can everyone be above average?
Yes.
And can everyone be below average?
Yes.
It'd be nice, but no. Not everyone can be above average and not everyone can be below average because we're measuring against each other.
Or as Einstein said, it's all relative.
Right. And my relatives, I don't know if they're below average or above average. I don't know.
It all depends which side of the family you're talking on, bud. You got to be careful here now.
All right. So coming back, what are the advantages / disadvantages of a strong or a weak currency?
Yes.
All right. Internally, to the United States, if we have a strong currency abroad,
da-da-da,
it means that we can buy things other places for less money here.
We can buy lots of stuff from China for cheap.
Right. We can go on vacation in Yugoslavia.
That's not even possible.
See what happens when currency issues get involved? Did you make countries just disappear?
Yes.
No, you can go.
You cannot go on vacation in Yugoslavia. Time travel is physically impossible.
So you can go to Eastern Europe and spend a lot less money when the United States dollar is stronger. However, if you are trying to sell things to China or sell things to Europe or sell things just about anywhere else, when the United States dollar is strong,
ta-da!
You may be able to sell the same product at the same price in China or the same product in the same price in Germany. But when you convert it back to dollars, you have less money.
Ah.
So the benefit of a strong dollar is that we can buy more stuff. The problem with a strong dollar is that selling stuff is less profitable.
And it's sometimes just more difficult. Which is why you notice at Caterpillar, which in the recent past has been a very strong company building lots of stuff and selling lots
right,
of stuff
all
overseas,
over the world,
is selling less stuff overseas because their stuff got more expensive because the dollar got more expensive.
Right. There are things that big companies can do to alleviate that. When the dollar gets strong, they can set up a plant to create Caterpillar products in another country.
Sometimes.
So there are obvious problems with that because then it's no longer an American product in
right.
the same sense. And Toyota did that with the United States. They said, oh, all we'll do, we'll just forget this currency risk deal. We'll just set up plants in the United States and build Toyota products there. And now Toyota builds more cars in the United States than they do in Japan. And more of the company is owned by Americans than by Japanese.
Well, one of the nice things about for instance, the dollar versus the euro. Your dollar, not all that long ago, was a dollar. It took $1.40 to buy a euro, and now it's like $1.11, $1.12 to buy a euro. That means the dollar has risen versus the euro, or the euro has fallen against the dollar. And you
it's very
can
hard
see,
to tell which.
Well, unless you're going to buy a Big Mac.
Right.
I still think that is the standard.
Well, it's a standard, except that there are certain countries where all of the stuff that goes into a Big Mac is a lot harder to come by.
That's
all the wheat,
right,
the
right,
lettuce, and
right.
things are things that have to be imported from elsewhere. So
I got that.
A Big Mac, while it is the same thing in different places, mm-hmm. if you made the bun out of rice, it may be more.
But this is the point that they try to maintain a degree of consistency in the Big Mac. It is acceptable to all religions except Hindus. And they don't sell them there. Well, maybe there's a veggie Big Mac they sell in India. Anyway,
I don't know.
Any rate, the Wall Street Journal every year does a Big Mac survey. They go because it is the only consistent consumer product sold universally.
Right.
Literally, in every nation of the world, Big Macs are sold.
This is one of the problems in economics, though, is that Big Macs may be sold everywhere, but in Afghanistan, a Big Mac is a massive percentage of a monthly salary.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point. But you still measured against everybody else's Big Macs and where it was last year against this year. So I think what we should do now. This is the secret.
Oh,
in investing,
here comes the secret.
This is the secret. Don't buy gold. Gold is no longer the international standard.
Big Mac futures.
Big Macs. Actually, a lot of people have done that in a peculiar sort of way. You ever heard of Mountain Home?
I've heard of Mountain Homes.
Yeah, but there's Mountain Home is a you can buy this plastic jug full of freeze-dried food.
Oh, yes.
And
yeah,
it's
selling
very well.
Uh-huh.
And you can actually measure what a certain segment of the population thinks about the future by noting
right.
the Mountain Home sales.
Kind of because that lasts a long time, and if you
yeah.
think that you're not going to
yeah.
be able to buy a lot of food at some point,
right.
either because you're going camping or because the food structure just fell apart.
Mm-hmm. Well, like leading up to the year 2000, they were selling.
Yes, a lot of people bought them.
I would say like hotcakes, but that's probably an inappropriate.
I think they have.
More like spaghetti.
They may have Mountain Homes hotcakes.
Yeah, but
they're selling literally like hotcakes.
I don't know that they have that. They do have a lot of spaghetti, though, and so they were selling like spaghetti.
Okay.
And spaghetti dinners are really big in some places. So
it's a good way of making a kind of checking the pulse on what people think governmental structure is going to be like in the future.
Following the subject of strong and weak currencies around about here, there, and yon, there's a couple of reasons that currencies rise and fall, and probably among the larger reasons is interest rates. For example,
right.
if you have a gazillion dollars and you are...
Do you know anyone with a gazillion dollars?
I don't know anybody with $1 billion, so gazillion is...
I know some people with $1 billion.
You do?
Yeah.
You know personally?
Yeah.
They have to have $1 billion?
Yes.
Where do they keep it? Where do they keep them?
Lots of places. Do I know them personally? They would recognize my face. I'm not sure they would remember my name.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I know them.
At any rate, I don't actually know anyone personally that has $1 billion ducats or dollars or whatever. And I'm not talking about net worth. I'm talking about the cash that they
right.
need to put somewhere.
Right.
And if you were a person, if you were Donald Trump doesn't actually have $1 billion in cash anywhere. He's got about a net worth of about $3 billion, but it's mostly in real estate, and it has huge loans leaned against it, so it can't do anything with it. But anyway,
right.
The point is, if you were one of the upper half quarter percent or whatever, the world's population in
a half of a quarter of a percent?
Something like that.
Okay.
A very tiny number of
an
people.
Eight.
Who have very, 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 very large quantities of money. And they really are having a lot of trouble figuring out what to do with it, which is one of those problems I've never had, but would like to give a try to see how it works. I'm told it's evil.
No, it's the root of evil.
That the love of it is the root of evil. The love of money is the root of evil, not money. But somehow, as Tevi said, you know, being rich is evil, but I'd like to try it to see. Any rate, that was from Fiddler on the Roof, by the way. The point is that if you are a person who wants to preserve your capital because you're uncertain about what's going on in the world, or you want to save your money, you want to do something short-term with it, you want to invest it someplace where it's likely to be fairly stable and where it actually might earn you some interest. Well, the people in the Eurozone, in that part of Europe that uses ducats, euros.
Right.
Were putting it in the bank because the bank would actually pay them a little bit of interest on it.
They use ducatis.
Ducatis?
Ducatis. And it's euros that are used to buy the ducatis.
Okay, got it. All
okay.
Right. So, but the problem, and it used to be there was something called jumbo CDs, where the more money you put in the bank, the higher the interest rate you got.
Right. That was when banks were actually giving loans.
Now, if throughout most of Europe, if you put your euros in the bank and you have a really, really, really large number of euros, they will charge you interest to hold it there, which is shocking. I say shocking, which actually those sort of make sense. They do insure it and they do protect it and they do keep up with it and all that stuff, and they don't have anybody to loan it to that'll pay them interest, so they're up a stump. Now, for example, the francs in Switzerland, of which I think there's only about three, the Swiss franc.
Ah, right.
Which is actually their currency, although the tribe of francs, there's probably very few of them left in Switzerland at this point. Their currency went up rather dramatically. They're the first people to go to negative interest rates because the people in the euro who were scared the euro was going to collapse during the Greek crisis started putting their money in Switzerland where they perceived there was safety. And in the process, they ran the Swiss franc up to amazingly high levels because you got to buy Swiss francs to put your money in the Swiss bank.
Right.
Because they only take Swiss francs. And the more something is bought, if there's only a certain amount of it, the higher the price goes. Well, this makes
supply and demand.
And this makes the selling of chocolate and cuckoo clocks incredibly expensive. Also, the selling of tourists. Or no, it's two tourists.
Yes, two tourists.
And so Switzerland was hurting economically because their currency was so stable.
Yes, currency got so stable that it got really strong because everybody else said, I'm going to put my money in Switzerland. And that caused the Swiss to go, hey, we're not going to give you any interest on this because we don't have to because you really want to give it to us. So we're going to charge you.
Right. We're going to charge
you, give us the money.
Deposit the money in our banks, which was the beginning of negative interest rates. Now, The Japanese have the same thing. There is a general consensus that the Japanese currency and the Japanese government is very, very stable because the Japanese people...
They're very strange.
They act a lot more like... Whatever the herd mentality is, they got it more than most people. Okay?
Yes.
They are very compliant.
That's a good way of saying.
And they work very, very hard. And in Japan, they don't even let bankrupt banks fail. They just keep them alive forever. And apparently one of the reasons recently discovered for the extreme longevity in certain villages in Japan.
It's because they don't let you die.
Is because just because you die doesn't mean you're reported as dead. You're just kept propped up in a chair and
right.
You continue to get your government subsidies. Well, they decided that worked so well, they'll do it with banks.
Yeah. So the bank longevity in Japan is just as great
right.
as some of their island longevities for their citizens. Yeah.
So the point is that the Japanese yen has actually stayed relatively strong in the world because a lot of people put their money there. It's called the carry trade, which doesn't make any sense at all. Now,
well, sure it does. The carry trade is it's where you carry the one, only you just keep carrying the one
forever.
It's
the trade about it is the problem.
Yeah, you're trading in that one.
How do you carry a trade?
On your back.
I guess. At any rate... So in the United States, we have a couple of things going for us. One, we're the only developed economy in the world that's actually growing.
Well, large developed economy in the world that's actually growing. We're the only major economic power that is growing well.
Right. Yeah. Yes. We're relatively healthy. All the indications are that we will continue to be relatively healthy. As the chief economist at the Conference Board, yes.
Conference Board.
Where they do the leading economic indicators, said in a recent press release, the United States is on a glide path to 2% GDP growth as far as the leading economic indicators can predict, which is we're going to pretty much do the same thing we've been doing going forward. The leading economic indicators are saying it's boring.
Yeah.
The rest of the world, Europe is trying, the Eurozone and the European Central Bank are trying really, really hard to avoid a major recession. They are all in that part of the world running scared that the Brexit will occur. I love that term, the Brexit.
The Brexit following the Grexit, which didn't happen.
Well, the Grexit didn't, even though Greece is going to default again, but everybody knows that, so it's no big thing.
The Brexit may happen after the non-Grexit.
Right. The Brexit, for those of you who are not familiar with the high levels of arcane financial terminology we use, is the British exit. Only
from
it's
the Eurozone.
It's technically
from
the
Euro.
It actually would be the Grexit.
They're not even leaving the Eurozone. They're talking
they're not
about
in the Eurozone.
Leaving the European Union.
Yes, they're talking about leaving the European Union,
secession.
Which would be an economic blow both to Great Britain, or not so Great Britain as the case would be, the United Kingdom, or whatever it's called, and the Eurozone, because both sides do a heck of a lot of trade with each other. Trade equals prosperity, equals money creation. And all of their trade treaties would go away if they left the
right.
European Union.
All of the trade treaties with Europe are based in the European Union now.
But one of the things that has not been considered is this is just a referendum.
Yes.
The parliament would have to agree to it. And just because the majority of people say, let's leave the Eurozone, doesn't mean they'll leave the Eurozone.
Well, it's the European Union.
I mean, you know, the European Union. They're not in the Eurozone. They'll leave the European Union. If they did leave the European Union, it probably would mark the end of the European Union.
We keep stumbling on this, so I'm going to explain it to the listeners.
The European Union zone.
Yeah. The European Union is kind of a confederacy of nations, or nation states, a confederacy of states in Europe.
But it's a confederacy that does not grow cotton.
It does not.
It's not the land of cotton.
Right.
Right.
They don't have a constitution. So there's nothing there that says they can't leave.
Right.
They can leave if they've just decided to go. There's nothing that's really holding them together except that they've all volunteered to stay together.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one of the problems that we've discussed about the European Union for a long time. Now, the next thing is the Eurozone. Internal to the European Union, there's a group of countries that have decided to combine their currencies into one currency, the euro. All the countries that do that are considered in the Eurozone. Well, there's some strange overlap that happens there because a lot of other countries surrounding the Eurozone also use the euro as well as their own currency.
Right.
So it gets very confusing on who's in the Eurozone and who isn't, because if Hungary is using both the forint and the euro and they say we're no longer going to use the euro, well, nothing really happens because the government doesn't decide who's using the euro. It's the people in the country and whether or not they want to do trade in a euro.
But they use the forint and the euro on the forex.
Yes. So when you're talking about the Eurozone, which is what the Grexit was about, the Grexit was talking about leaving the Eurozone.
That was no longer
using the euro as currency.
Right. The default. It was default of the Greeks.
Yes, default of the Greeks.
And if they were to leave, they were concerned that the Eurozone would fall apart because nobody'd ever left before. And
right.
They had no provisions for them leaving.
Yeah. What would that do to the value of the euro and so on? Now, the Brexit, which is the British leaving the European Union, isn't leaving the Eurozone because they're still using the pound, but they're part of the European Union. They're talking about leaving the Union.
They're leaving a free trade zone.
Right. And so that's kind of the same sentiment that both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are talking about with our TPP and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, all the NAFTA, all of our free trade agreements. There is a movement right now to say we should buy local and we should no longer use a global economy to do that. And if you go back through history, even if just we're talking about history of the United States, that was said internally in the United States. The North didn't want to buy from the South. The South didn't want to buy from the North. You go even further back than that, you've got minor colonies not wanting to buy from other colonies. The more we open the borders for trade, the more capitalism has the opportunity to work.
Which is why the conservatives in the Republican Party are against it.
Actually, this is one of the fascinating points.
It is.
The conservatives are not against it. It's the new Republicans that are against it. And there are a lot of new Republicans. The party's shrinking. A lot of the old Republicans that were conservative fiscally have left because the new Republicans coming in are not conservative fiscally. They want social programs, and they want no more free trade. They want basically to unionize the United States.
I don't know that very many Republicans would agree with you on that.
Union
is still an evil word.
I agree with you. They wouldn't use the word union. But when you're talking about stopping free trade, only purchasing from people in the United States, that's unionizing. That is saying you don't buy from anybody but us. And that is the nature of union. Now it's still a dirty word in the Republican Party to say unions, except not so dirty anymore because a lot of the coal miners are coming in and they're a union.
It's actually protectionism. And I think it's a return to its roots. The Republican Party is returning to its roots of the early
1930s. There's some roots of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Protectionism.
Right. Close the borders.
Yeah.
Only buy inside.
Right. Cut taxes.
What that does, though, is it stifles business. It means that it doesn't just affect us. Donald Trump has said, let's slap a 45% tariff on Chinese goods. That would cause prices across the board in the United States to go up. It would go up drastically.
Well, the Fed would get its instant inflation.
Oh, man, would it ever.
We'd get a recession and inflation. We could have stagflation again.
Right. Bernie Sanders has said something similar. He said that we would put tariffs on.
I think his was 35%.
Yeah, 35. It's not quite as much, so the prices wouldn't go up quite as much. But he's got a lot of other governmental programs where we would be just be printing money and giving it to people. So that would cause inflation as well.
The point is, now, both of them, it's pretty fascinating to me. Both of them have targeted China specifically.
Yes.
Which was pretty fascinating in that under international agreements, we would be violating a lot of treaties, A.
Right.
And B, it would be broadly construed as a declaration of war on China.
Yes.
China wouldn't be broad about construing it as a declaration of war. China would have to hire a tremendous amount of people who were instantly put out of work, and they'd probably have uniforms. A lot of them would be making uniforms, and the rest of them would be wearing the uniforms, and then they'd have to make a lot of rifles and a lot of airplanes and a lot of ships.
This is what led...
While we went into a severe recession where we couldn't afford to buy rifles, airplanes,
this is what turned a recession in the 30s into a depression in the 30s. This is what caused Japan to attack us, is the tariffs that we slapped on Japan. They thought we were declaring war on them. Now, that doesn't give them an excuse to show up and attack us. Don't get me wrong there. But by the definition of most of the world, all we have to do is look at what we're doing with North Korea. We're afraid of North Korea. North Korea is building nuclear weapons. They're testing ballistic missiles. They are talking about miniaturizing warheads. Our response to a military threat is to, in essence, tariff them, to shut down trade with them. That's that is a step short of military action.
That's what we did to Iran. and that's what we've done to Russia. As a result of their military action, our response was to restrict trade.
Well, now, we do
tariffs
it.
Do restrict trade.
Right. When we restrict trade with a country based on their military action, when they're doing something that we see as repugnant and threatening to us physically, it's a good response.
It is.
It's a good diplomatic way of saying, hey, this is one step short of us physically attacking you because you're being very scary right now.
Mm-hmm.
When we do it to a nation because they're doing good business, because the Chinese are following an American model of commerce, we say, wait, you're doing it too well, so we're going to take our toys and go home. That is threatening without a threat. This is us starting the threatening. This is us going forward and saying, we're threatening you at your income. We're taking your income away because we don't like you. And we think that our less competitive services should do better.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying this extremely bluntly.
Well, this is all to do with currency wars, if you will.
Right.
For whatever it's worth, the Chinese are working really, really hard to run their currency up against the dollar, which you would think would be sort of a form of insanity.
Except that they are.
The objective there is to try to keep the currency in China.
Right.
If it drops well below the dollar, people will
try to convert it
into dollars because they will perceive that the Chinese currency is falling and the dollar is rising. China wants to be recognized on the world scene as a major, as a developed country, as a player on the world scene. And so they have to stabilize things. The current rhetoric in the two left and right extremes, which is very similar with regard to foreign policy, is a little bit scary to everybody out there. And it's one of the reasons, by the way, that we are seeing the instability. Now, the caller had a second question, or the first question, actually. And that was, do the central banks, have the central banks lost control of the issue? There's a debate going on that. And it's a very reasonable debate.
Let me throw something in here first. That's not technically the job of the Federal Reserve. They're not supposed to preserve the currency value outside of our own borders. So go ahead. Have they lost control of that?
The issue is that normally and historically, when interest rates are lowered, the value of the currency of the nation that just lowered its interest rates goes down because people want to store their money someplace else. At this particular moment in time, it isn't working that way. It's working the other way around. People are far more concerned, as Will Rogers once said, about return of their money than they are return on their money. The Chinese kind of led the way in this. We've been saying for some time the Chinese have been buying U.S. Treasury securities at a negative net yield. And then everybody was surprised when Janet Yellen said, oh, yeah, we don't anticipate doing this, but we could go to negative interest rates. Well, folks, we've had negative interest rates for some time.
Yeah.
In that, if you buy a Treasury Inflation Protected Security, TIPS, and you buy a long-term version, at least over the last year or so, if you look at the promised return of principal, it is a lower dollar amount than that Treasury security was selling for at the initial auction. In other words, the thing was issued at one price where they promised that 20 or 30 years later, they will pay you back less money. Now, you'll get interest along the way. That interest is variable with inflation, and it has been pretty much zero recently because we haven't had any significant inflation. But the point is that we are in an unusual situation historically where a tremendous amount of money disappeared in the world. And when nation states or groups of nation states, such as in the Eurozone, adjust interest rates down to try to force people to spend more money, it has some interesting effects in that lowering interest rates, for example, in the Eurozone caused the euro to rise because people concluded that lowering interest rates in the Eurozone meant that the euro was more likely to be there 10 years from now than it was before.
We're starting to see something a little bit strange as well, and that is that the long-term interest rates are trending upwards in places that have short-term negative rates.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, is that a mouthful of boring-sounding stuff.
It's interesting, though.
It is interesting if you listen to...
If you're a geek.
If you dig down into it and you say, okay, why does that matter? Usually, if you're trying to get a loan and your loan is short-term, you don't pay anything on it, or very, very little, because they're only going to give it to you if you really have good credit, and or if you're going to say, for instance, if you loan it to a bank, you're not going to get a lot of interest. A short-term loan to a bank is what we call a bank account. You put money in the bank, and they can use that money. They also have the obligation to give it back to you whenever you show up. That's called short-term. You could put it on deposit today and take it out in 5 minutes. That's very short term. But you've given it to a bank who has really, really good credit.
So the question I wanted to address here. Did I interrupt you?
Yeah, I was going to go to the long-term rates.
Go ahead.
The long-term rates have been trending upwards slowly, but trending upwards in countries that have negative interest rates on the short-term money. And that is because the negative interest rates are the banks are being charged money to deposit their reserves and anything above their reserves at the central bank. That's what's really going on here. These big banks, when their central bank says you've got to have money in reserve plus some, rather than loaning money out, they're keeping all the money in reserve, and they're keeping a lot more money in reserve because they're not getting enough interest on their loans to make it worth their while, so they just deposit it at the central bank. The central bank has now said, all right, well, in that case, we're going to charge you money to have that on deposit with us. So these big banks have to turn around and go, well, then we have to loan it out, or we're going to be losing money, and our shareholders don't like that. Well, the only way we can do this profitably is if we raise interest rates on mortgages. If we go out and we say our 30-year loans need to go up as the interest rate, otherwise we're not going to make a profit. We're going to lose money short-term, and we're going to lose money long-term. So the interest rates long-term are trending upwards in places with these short-term. And this is another reason why the euro has strengthened again in the recent, where right after Draghi said that they were going to start charging interest rather than giving interest on deposits, the long-term rates started going up. The eurozone's, the euro value started going up as well. And now, back to you.
Well, we're about out of time for this hour.
What?
Yeah.
We have lots of commercials?
We have about 10 minutes left, but we do have a commercial left to play. So
okay,
we'll play a commercial, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
Hi.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone numbers in here remain, a number in here remains, 254, that's the area code, 773-1400. The question was, have the central banks lost control of the world economic situation? The answer is no. They're off doing some unusual things, and very frankly, this week you're going to see a lot of crazy stuff in the news. Last week particularly. The reason is there's not very much to write about except Donald Trump. And the economics guys are probably tired of writing about Donald Trump. So they have to write about something. And so whenever you have a headline in the news media, in the Wall Street Journal, anywhere else, that is a question or suggests a question. Banks may have lost. The may have is
right.
The question. That generally means that the person who's writing about it doesn't have any real news to write about, so they're going to speculate a little bit, and they're kind of bored, and they've got to put something on the paper, because in weeks when there's lots of really earth-shaking things going on, they have so many columns to fill. And in weeks when there's nothing of any significance going on, they have exactly the same number of column inches to fill. It's kind of like every week we come in here and we have 2 hours to fill up. Most of 2 hours anyway, because the news fills some of it and commercials fill some of it. And in some weeks, like last week, there was way more stuff than we could get to. And right. in there's other weeks like this week when
there's not a lot of news.
Lord,
that's
what
out.
Are we going to talk about? For I mean, because the news really. It's that time of year, and we get these periods of time. Now, significantly, we need to say before the hour runs out that the stock market, that ubiquitous, that's my word for the week, ubiquitous, I'm not sure what it means, but it sure sounds cool, that ubiquitous indicator of economic prosperity or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm.
You like that? The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 2.3%, 2.9%.
It was down
2.9%? Yes. For the 52-week period.
Ah. Aha.
Actually, it was up for the week, 2.26%. The Standard & Poor's 500 Stock Index, which is a little broader picture of the what's going on, is up 1.35%. It's also down 2.78%. For the 52-week period. So the big deal is neither one of those numbers. And the headlines were awash with the really, really, really what they thought was important number, which is we pick an arbitrary day, which is this is January 1st is an arbitrary day. From January 1st until Friday, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index was up 0.28%, and there was much rejoicing. Now, I want you to think about this. This is April. This is the middle of April. That means January, February, March. So 3.5 months into the year, the stock market, had you invested on January 1st, which you couldn't have, by the way, because it's a holiday, and you can't invest in the whole market anyway, you'd be up 0.28% had you done something that was impossible. And that's headlines, which
right.
tells you exactly how informative some of this stuff is. The reality is, as we were coming in, as I look at almost everything, and as we run out of hour here, as I look at almost everything, it's all the same thing. Fill in the blank. Stuff is up more than it has been recently, but less than it once was.
Right.
Is there anything else we need to say?
Yeah, that really covers the markets. Now, let me talk about some technology changes that have come out.
Oh, some commodity other than truck trains?
All right, other than truck trains. Integra Gold Corporation.
Oh,
is a corporation which, obviously that mines for gold.
Oh, I thought they mined for Integra.
No.
Okay.
No. They had a competition called, amazingly, the Gold Rush Challenge.
Really?
Where they had they put it out to everybody out there, MIT, a whole bunch of other people, basically the same kind of methodology that DARPA has used for robotics and so on, that said, we want you to come up with machine learning, AI, big data, statistical models to show us where gold is using the data from satellites and data from known geological surveys.
Ah.
They just awarded $500,000 to a team called the SGS Geosat team. Because the challenge was there's this huge piece of property in Quebec that is owned by Integra.
I think it's Quebec.
Quebec?
Yes.
It's not Quebec?
No. The French have...
I don't speak French.
Yeah, but we are in North America with them, and if you ever cross into Canada, which you do from time to time,
yes.
you need to pronounce this Quebec.
I will do my best.
All right. Just wanted
but
to...
it definitely starts with right. a Q-U. So, Quebec.
Yes.
There's a very large piece of property out there that has some gold on it. And so all these teams put forth their data, and all the teams did well. This is one of those interesting factors in that the assays of the different locations that were given by the different teams, and some of the teams had overlaps, so the same location was given multiple times, which tells you something about the technology. the winning team got every assay really, really right, and that there was lots of gold in all the spots that they said there was gold.
Mm-hmm.
This is without going on the ground with a pick. This is without going out and saying, I think we should dig on that hill over there. This was without being on the property at all and looking at a computer screen. This is the sort of technology that's impacting fracking. It's the sort of technology that's happening in all the commodities markets right now. The computer systems are learning enough to say where items are based on other discoveries in the past and based on a lot of new data that's come out that we didn't even know was there, that may have been old data that was not being used properly. I'm saying that because this is one tiny fraction of the new technology that's coming out that says that the world stage, the technology growth, is happening faster and faster, which means that the profitability of gold at low prices is going to be better. The profitability of oil at low prices is going to be better.
But you still got to dig it out of the ground.
You still do have to dig it out of the ground.
And in, but in Quebec, I kind of suspect that the environmental restrictions on digging gold out of the ground may be substantial.
It is, but that's why this is such a good thing, because getting it out of the ground, if you don't even know it's in the ground, you've got to go through the same environmental restrictions and then maybe not have gold at the end of it,
mm-hmm.
versus only going through the environmental restrictions when you know you're going to have a payoff.
That makes sense. And, you know, one of the things that I think that a lot of people in talking to them were unaware of, they saw it in some of the science fiction movies maybe recently, that the farmers who sit in their house and automated right. tractors and
combines
and so on are running around out there, not running around, rolling around out there.
Without people in them.
Doing the agricultural work without people being involved.
My wife's uncle owns a big combine service and dairy farm in Canada, and none of his combines have drivers.
And that type of thing is a huge wave of the future. I want to talk about that some more next hour, but you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach on KTEM. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we have a local number. We do manage investment portfolios for people. And our telephone number is, of course, 254-947-1111, or
you can reach that same number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, tpwc.com, or thepersonalwealthcoach.com. We've got podcasts there. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.